The GPM is a listener-supported podcast. If you enjoy what you're hearing, go to greenplanetmonitor.net and click on the subscribe button. We'll be very grateful. Now, back to my conversation about Iran with Ervand Abrahamian.
Netanyahu managed to convince Donald Trump that the regime could be toppled within a matter of days, just like the Venezuelan government was toppled and Maduro was arrested, and the same way Saddam Hussein was toppled, and the same way that Muammar Gaddafi was toppled, the Iranian regime could be toppled in a matter of days. It would take like a week, and that's proven to be wrong. And everybody talks about how distributed Iranian governance is, that the Iranian regime is incredibly robust, capable of resisting assault because it isn't centralized, as people might have imagined the Iranian regime to be incredibly centralized. In fact, it's not. Some say that Iran has turned the tables on Israel and the United States, and that they've actually achieved a strategic victory. And to the extent that that's true, it may well be because power is decentralized in Iran.
Yeah, if you look back to early January, February of this year, with the demonstrations in Iran, which were basically due to the sanctions, the economic pressures, there's a lot of discontent. And the regime probably has at most 15% of the population supporting it.
Just 15%?
It's lost. It has alienated so many groups within the country. And from that, the presumption was from Israel that the regime was so fragile that just 3 days of bombing, it would collapse. They talked about regime change, but I think the Israelis knew that there was the prospect of the Shah coming back or regime change was not in the books. Because the Revolutionary Guards, even if the population was not supporting the regime, the Revolutionary Guards are strong enough and have enough, basically, firepower to remain in power, to keep the regime in power. It's not a huge military, like 500,000 men under the Shah. It's about 150,000 Revolutionary Guards. But they basically represent the 15% that support the regime. They're ideologically very committed. Many of them served in the war against Iraq. Many of them have helped the so-called proxies over the period. So it's a very ideologically committed group that is not going to crumble. So what I think the Israelis misjudged is thinking that because the popular support for the regime had shrunk to 15-20%, it was about to collapse. And for them, the collapsing would mean the disintegration of a society, the disintegration of Iran into small ethnic groups. So there was a speech that Trump made on the eve of this war, where he encouraged the various ethnic groups in Iran to rise up, like the Kurds, the Baluchis, the Azerbaijanis. He gave a whole list of minorities to basically participate in the revolt. And in the last of the list he gave was a list, a group that I'd never heard of. So I did what most people do. You Google to find out who these people are. It turns out they exist in the other side of the Caucasus in Dagestan, in Russia. So the question becomes, why is that group put in there among Iran as a minority that is dying to be liberated from the regime when they don't even exist in Iran? So is it because some intern in the White House basically threw some name in, or is it someone in Mossad thinks that if there's going to be a civil war in Iran, disintegration, they could bring in mercenaries from Dagestan to this was sounds fantastic, but this was done actually in Iraq, in Syria, where people from Central Asia were brought in to fight for democracy against Assad. So I think their long range plan in Israel was in fact the disintegration of Iran in the civil war based on ethnicity. That didn't work. Why? Because the state held together. The Revolutionary Guards were actually savvy enough, and as you mentioned, the decentralization helped. And also what helped actually is the war itself. Because once Israel and the United States began to attack, and the atrocities of, you know, killing the girls, bombing the girls' school, destroying almost every attack, bombing of almost every university in the country, the destruction of the Pasteur Institute, which is is something from the 1920s, of basically creating vaccines, penicillin for the country. These things have basically changed the mood in the country. So even people who dislike the regime are much more willing to either keep quiet or support the regime, because they feel that what Israel is planning is the disintegration of the whole society. And therefore, it's better to have even if a regime you don't like, rather than the chaos that developed in Iraq, Libya, Syria. So I would say that actually the war has helped the regime get more, I would say, legitimacy. And if it becomes clear that it's actually a defeated United States in the Gulf, and the Gulf is now actually not just in name a Persian Gulf, but the Iranian Gulf, this will be a big victory for Iran, and that would give it some credibility to the regime. It might not boost it up for basically another generation, but in the short run, it'll give it basically some sort of popularity, not on the basis of Islam, but much more on the basis of Iranian nationalism.
And will Iran manage to hold on to the Strait of Hormuz and turn it into effectively a toll-controlled waterway that Iran can generate income from? And power, I mean, forget about developing a nuclear arsenal, which they say they don't want to do. And, you know, what usefulness do nuclear weapons serve? But actually controlling and exacting tolls from the Strait of Hormuz, now that's a strategic advantage of considerable worth.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they'll be interested in collecting tolls, but the fact that they will decide who can come and go from the Gulf is basically what gives them the power in their area.
And are they going to retain that power?
I don't see how they can actually lose it. I mean, short of the United States sending foot soldiers to occupy the other side of the Gulf, it's easy for Iran just with the drones and short-range missiles on their side of the Gulf to basically control who comes and goes. And also, I mean, they have the capability of also destroying any of the Gulf states that wants to openly ally with Israel and the United States. So already they've inflicted a great deal of damage to the United Emirates. But, you know, they've made it clear to the Saudis, to Qatar, to Kuwait, Bahrain, that they are capable of destroying those countries, basically, with what they have. So in reality, Iran is now the dominant force in the Gulf.
Now, as we speak, I've not checked the news, but Donald Trump is perhaps he's already touched down in Beijing and is holding talks with the Xi Jinping. Trump and Xi Jinping are talking. What would you imagine Xi Jinping is saying to Donald Trump? What do you think he might be advising Donald Trump to do or not to do?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure he would be even offering advice, or because from the Chinese point of view, the present situation is perfectly fine for them. U.S. is bogged down in a crisis, quagmire. They're withdrawing basically their forces from the Pacific. This gives the Chinese actually much more leeway in the Pacific.
But they're getting most of their oil, if I understand correctly, from Iran.
That oil is not that important because actually they're not that reliant on oil. They'll continue getting oil from Iran. What I suspect is this will be not recorded, but this would be what Trump would be doing is pleading, basically with the Chinese to help him somehow to get Iran to back down, basically asking Chinese help to get Trump out of this mess. And so it's actually, I think the cards are in the hands of the Chinese here. And
how would Xi Jinping help the Americans get out of this mess?
Well, they could say, the Gulf will be opened. The U.S. will stop the blockade. Iran will stop the blockade. There'll be free flow, which is good for the Chinese. And somehow Trump can have some sort of new nuclear agreement, which will be basically the same as the Obama agreement, which he denounced as the worst agreement ever made. But he could package it in a slightly different way. And here you'll see, I think, that a divergence of interest between Trump and Israel, because for Trump, some sort of deal over the nuclear issue, which would be sort of Obama 2 deal without the name of Obama, that would fit into Trump's interest and U.S. interest, because that way he can get out of this mess. I mean, the reality, in I think Mossad would probably accept it, that Iran will have a nuclear research, again with the verifications that it's not a bomb research.
Do you see the United States and Israel going into Iran in order to extract those 600 kilos of highly enriched uranium? Do you see that happening?
I can't see that happening, because it will be a question of occupation, very messy. And also, it doesn't make sense. I mean, Trump claimed that nuclear material was obliterated. So why
dust.
Is he concerned about
dust?
Yeah. So, we don't know even where the stuff is. I don't think people know where it is. We know that before the bombing, the American bombing of the installations, there were trucks moving that stuff out of there, so they could move to all sorts of places. So it'd be a wild goose chase trying to find where the enriched uranium is. So I think that a much more reasonable solution is actually an agreement, going back to the verification type of agreement that Obama had. Would be the way to solve the issue.
How do you see Iranian governance and society evolving over the course of the next, 5, 10, 15, 25 years, if a resolution that's just and equitable and rational is achieved in the course of what's going on right now, if Israel and the United States fail to topple the regime and some kind of an agreement is reached that's relatively stable and equitable? Do you see the Iranian regime becoming a little bit softer and more just, and there being an opening to social debate? And I was talking with Aran Keshavarzian, who I believe you know, Aran Keshavarzian, at NYU. He's a he's
Arang,
an academic, Arang. And he was talking about how, just in the midst of recent events, one was seeing women in the market in Iran, not covered, without any hair covering. And I mean, this is perhaps an anecdotal observation, but that there seems to be a certain opening, a societal opening, that there is a greater ability to engage in discourse. And I mean, oppression now is incredibly intense, and Iran is executing people, and people are in jail, and it's a difficult time to criticize the regime. But if things stabilize and a just and equitable settlement is reached, how do you see Iranian society and governance evolving?
I think, I mean, once there is basically some sort of normalcy, especially if sanctions are removed, the economy begins to grow, what you would find, I think, is the regime itself realizes that the old ideology of the Islamic Revolution is no longer sustainable. The discourse has completely changed. You know, in 78-79, the whole politics was in the discourse of Islam. You know, what is Islam, going back to roots and so on. People had different interpretations, but Islam was the premise people worked with. That's dropped. The new generation that has grown up under the Islamic Republic has, in fact, basically discarded that discourse. And the discourse they've developed, unconsciously, but very reminiscent of the Enlightenment discourse, is liberty, equality, fraternity.
And where is this discourse happening?
In the streets. I mean,
this is in the streets.
In the women's movement, for instance, the protests, if you look at the slogans, the arguments they had, was basically the ideas of individual rights. You know, I as a woman or a person have certain rights. It's not something that is given to me. It's natural. It's part of my, you know, existence. And the whole idea of using of Islam in politics has become actually repugnant to the new generation. This turns people off. So I think the regime itself has already realized that. That's why they don't enforce things like the hijab. It's the pastars are not out in the street telling women to wear headgear. But they've given up on that. Why? Because they know it just creates such a backlash. It's seeped through society, this new type of discourse. So the regime at some point, I think, will have to actually even change the constitution, because the constitution has given so much power to the clerics, which was not the original intention of the revolution. So what you had was quite a secular constitution, which was then transported into a clerical constitution with a lot of actually opposition to it. The way to regain, I think, legitimacy for the republic is to go back to some sort of secular constitution and dismantle the present constitution, because the present constitution is very much gives almost monopolistic power to the clerics. They have veto over almost everything.
And is there a discussion going on in Iran about this? I mean, at this instance, I'm sure there isn't, but prior to the war, Israel-USA's war on Iran, was it being discussed?
There was a lot of discussion about amending the Constitution, which there is clauses actually in the Constitution that to change the Constitution, but there's so many obstacles to that. It's very difficult to change the Constitution. That's why I think it'll have to be completely replaced by a new Constitution. No one now could talk about that, but I think once things normalize, that will be the obvious problem. Is, you know, you can't really liberalize under the present constitution, because any liberal states take, the diehard clerics could veto it.
And wouldn't that be a good reason to reach an equitable solution? Wouldn't that be a great point, arguing point for European politicians? From Macron and Starmer and Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney and all the rest of these Western people, that if they really want Iran to become a more liberal society with a greater degree of human rights, that the best solution is to just accept Iranian sovereignty and the greatness of the Iranian nation and just stop assaulting it.
Well, I think that implicitly that was their argument before. That's why they supported some sort of rapprochement, because they felt such a rapprochement would help the more liberals in the republic, like the president Khatami, Rouhani, which were much more open, that any normalization would help them, and they being stronger, would be much more forthcoming in normalizing relations. That was actually stopped because the U.S. had control over the dollar. The secondary sanctions threatened Europe and Canada that if they didn't go along with the hard U.S. policy, they get penalized. So I think once Europe and Canada has declared independence from the United States, so hopefully they'll form some sort of economic substitute to the dollar, that could help, you know, basically in liberalizing the system.
Do you have an idea, Professor Abrahamian, about what Iran has to offer to the global community, culturally, politically, socially? Once peace is achieved, if we can imagine peace ever being achieved, we're going into a period of climate breakdown. We are in the midst of climate breakdown. So in 30 or 40 or 50 years, the whole region may be completely roasted by climate change, right? Yeah. So the future is pretty dark in terms of just kind of biophysical conditions on the surface of the planet. Who knows what it's going to be like in Iran and across the Eastern Mediterranean. But if a peaceful, just global order is achieved, what is it about Iran that people should consider and admire and look to? What does the Iranian nation have to offer to the world?
Well, I mean, Iran, with its actually large population, 90 million, has also a very large educated in technology. Since the revolution, the higher education is dramatically expanded. So it has one of the highest percentage of basically highly qualified people in the sciences. And you already can see in the diaspora so many Iranians that are very prominent in whether in the medical or research field. Iran is actually very well placed to actually be in the scientific world in development. And of course, a lot of the problems that exist, such as water problems, the environmental problems, climate problems, these are issues that directly affect Iran. Iran would be in a very good position to be actually to be able to carry out research and find solutions for that, because it has immediate reason for being involved in that. It can't ignore climate change like Trump can ignore it. It directly affects the country. Iran, I think, as a unit, if it was part of the international community, would have a lot to offer, basically, what the international community needs, especially in terms of global warming and a shortage of water. Even the simple things like the water level collapsing, falling, and the whole agricultural problems that has caused, not just in Iran, but throughout the Middle East.
And do you have any hope for the future? Last question. Is the future, I hesitate saying bright, but what does the future hold if you can take out the tea leaves? How do you see this evolving?
Well, I was very hopeful under the Obama period, and if that had continued, I think things would have evolved very differently. Hopefully, we can go back to the Obama period after Trump, and then the film start rolling from there, and I think there'll be some opening then.
And once Netanyahu is gone?
I think the problem in Israel is more than Netanyahu, but it'd be good if he went. But I think there is a sort of obsession in Israel somehow that the Palestinian issue can be basically put aside. I think in Israel, the problem won't be solved until Israel realizes that issue of Palestine has to be addressed.
And only the Western powers can, in my view, can solve that problem. Israel is never going to deliver justice and self-determination to the Palestinian people. It's going to have to be the most powerful nations of the West, I would imagine, beginning with the United States, but European Union and Canada can do that. And if they were to do that, it would be a natural kind of concomitant to bring about some kind of rational solution to this conflict with Iran, which is, in a sense, a concocted conflict.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, Trump is not going to be there forever. So, you know, eventually we'll have some new administration in Washington, and hopefully we'll address the issue rather than listen to Netanyahu on what should be done about Iran.
Professor Ervand Abrahamian, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you for listening to me.
Ervand Abrahamian is a professor of history at Baruch College and Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Among the books he's authored, Iran Between Two Revolutions, Khomeinism, Essays on the Islamic Republic, Tortured Confessions, Prisons and Public Recantations in Modern Iran, Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria, and A History of Modern Iran. Professor Abrahamian's latest work, Oil Crisis in Iran, From Nationalism to Coup d'Etat, explores the motivations of the U.S.-UK engineered overthrow of Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh in August 1953, based on previously unreleased diplomatic communications. Continued favorable access to Iranian oil was the key driver of the CIA MI6 engineered coup, not fears of Soviet influence over the democratically elected Mossadegh administration. For more on this and my complete conversation with Ervand Abrahamian, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a joint production of Earth Chronicle Productions and 93.3 CFMU-FM, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Thanks to our news editor, Kylie Wong. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Subscribe while you're there. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Blueberry, and on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hey, do you want to make a real impact in the Black community? Join us where we connect you with Black-led organizations from all around the world. Get ready to get involved. Find the organization based on the location of interest. Follow us at supportblackcharities.org.
This is